Okay, Erev Tov. Welcome back to our third session of our mini course on Shir HaShirim. Tonight we're going to be talking about nature in Shir HaShirim. Should I put this down a little bit? I feel like it's okay. Yeah? All right. We called this session "Let Nature Be Your Teacher." It's a quote from William Wordsworth's poem on what we can learn from nature. Plants, animals, and seasons in Shir HaShirim. So tonight we're going to discuss the role of nature in Shir HaShirim. This is yet another piece in the intricately woven tapestry of Shir HaShirim, which we've mentioned over and over is designed to propel humans forward in their quest for obtaining love and on both levels, both in the finite world and the ultimate holy of holies, which is, of course, love of God. We've discussed at length the idea that the man-woman relationship allows humans to acquire tools for developing a relationship with God. And in tonight's class, what I want to show you is how mankind's relationship with nature allows him to acquire these tools for both levels of relationship, that in the human world and that in the divine realm. What I want to begin by observing is that the flowering of the land has a very prominent role in Shir HaShirim. The book is constantly describing the blossoming of the land and the movement of the blossoming of the land, the slow but sure organic development of the land, the buds, the flowers, the fruit, the spices. Throughout the story, and this is, I think, the premise that we're going to begin with, throughout the story, the growth and the development of the relationship between the dod and the raya, between the man and the woman, runs parallel to and in consonance with the growth and the development of the natural world, which occurs as the backdrop of Shir HaShirim. Nature is used in many different ways. One way that it's used is as evidence of the continued organic growth of the relationship. So the relationship is described as growing, right? It indicates when we have in the background the growth of nature, it's indicating metaphorically that gradually, slowly but surely, the seeds that the couple has planted take root, that the careful cultivation of the relationship first yields its initial buds, and then those buds become these beautiful, sweet-smelling flowers, and eventually the beautiful, sweet-smelling flowers ripen into the fruits that are ready to be picked and to be eaten, so that this becomes a metaphor for the development of the relationship. A second point that we're going to note as well, and that is that the natural habits of the animal kingdom, which are also part of the backdrop of Shir HaShirim, and we're going to be seeing that as well, their rituals of courtship, their organic mating, right? How it happens in a natural way, according to the seasons, are also used as a metaphor to describe the developing relationship between the dod and the raya. If you remember, in the first class, we noted that the book opens with the raya's premature desire to be at the end of the book, right? Remember, she opens by saying, Yishakeni minashikot pihu, ki tovim dodecha miayin. He should kiss me with the kisses of his lips, for your love is better than wine. She wants already her beloved to take her into his chamber, right? Heviani hamelech hadarav nagila v'nismechavach, right? This is the very, very beginning of Shir HaShirim. These are the initial psukim in Shir HaShirim. She wants to enter her beloved's chamber. She wants to experience being kissed by him. She wants to drink the already fermented wine, right? So she wants to already sort of skip over all of the slow and gradual organic growth that we experience in the world, in the natural world of Shir HaShirim, and really just to jump to the end and already to be drinking the wine. But what we saw afterwards is that she has not yet planted her vineyard, right? So how could she get the wine? There's no vineyard, and she hasn't tended it, and she hasn't watered it, and she hasn't pruned it, and she hasn't done any of the necessary work in order to bring out the fruits and eventually to make the fruits into the wine. So what wine is she drinking, right? And this, again, I mean, this, I think, is the reason that her initial excitement and almost immature, if not perhaps premature, excitement that we meet at the very beginning of Shir HaShirim is very much mitigated by the more measured response of her dode, who first doesn't answer her, right? He first sort of stays rather elusive in the background. And then when she accuses him, basically, of not answering her because he finds her unattractive, right? Don't look at me as if I am black because the sun has made me so. He contradicts her, and he says, he calls her Hayafa Binashim, and he says to her, if you don't yet know how to find me, imlo tedilach Hayafa Binashim, tzi'ilach bi'ikvei hatzon uri'i et gidiotayach. Right, we talked about this. Go out and develop your shepherding skills, develop your character in preparation for the relationship. Right, so this also, I think, showed us that there needs to be some sort of development, and that the development is meant to somehow parallel the development of the natural organic world. And that's really what I want to see inside tonight. The first song of Shir HaShirim appears in the first chapter, and it continues a little bit into the second chapter. Again, one of the things that we noted in our initial class is that there are a lot of difficulties with Shir HaShirim. And one of the difficulties with Shir HaShirim is dividing Shir HaShirim into its constituent songs. One thing I can tell you for sure, and that is that we're not going to follow the chapter divisions. The chapter divisions are not ours, right? They are not done by Masoretic Jewish tradition. Rather, they are a Christian tradition, right? And so we don't follow them, and they're not actually particularly good in Shir HaShirim. Sometimes the chapter divisions seem to be better done than actually in Shir HaShirim. The first song ends in chapter 2, verse 7, and I want to actually take you to the second song. I want to see what happens in the second song. The first song really records a development, which we talked about in the first class, in which, as I said, initially she seems very excited, almost brimming over with excitement, and he kind of puts the brakes on it, and slowly but surely they make their way to a certain mirroring, to a certain reciprocity, which we spoke about in the last class, right? This hinach yafa, right? Hinach yafa rayati, hinach yafa einayich yoni. Behold, you are beautiful. And she responds to him, Hincha yafe dodi. And so they eventually do begin to see eye to eye as this first song progresses. And in fact, there's one verse that I want to draw your attention to that is in that first song before we get to the second song. And that is verse 17 in chapter 1. What I want you to see in verse 17 in chapter 1 is that as part of the development of this song, they begin to build a house together. Okay, this house is going to be important for the second song. Look at how they described it. Korot batenu arazim, the beams of our house are cedars, are cedar trees. Rahitenu birotim, our corridors, it says here, are cypresses. Okay, so again, there certainly is an allusion to the Beit HaMikdash, which we spoke about last time, right? Those cedar trees, those beautiful, sweet-smelling wood that was used in the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. But for the purposes of the simple meaning of the text, what we really have here is just the construction of the house, right? They're building a house together. And note that this is in plural form, right? Korot batenu. We are building a house. Have they moved into that house together? Well, it doesn't seem that they have yet moved into that house together. And one of the indications of this is the beginning of the second song. So let's start with chapter 2, verse 8. Chapter 2, verse 8, I'm starting the second song here for two reasons. First of all, Rashi starts the second song here. The Targum seems to see a whole new chain of events that happens here. But also, if you look at chapter 2, verse 7, we have almost this concluding verse. Hishpati etchem benot Yerushalayim, batzvaot, o be'ayalot ha-sadeh, im ta'iru ve'im ta'aru et ahava ad she'techpatz, which seems to close many of our songs in Shir HaShirim. This is actually a refrain. It's an oath that she takes in Shir HaShirim three times, maybe four times with variations, and it seems to almost put the brakes on the relationship. She says, I have taken an oath, Benot Yerushalayim, by the gazelles and the hinds of the field, that you should not awaken the love until the proper time. And that seems to close the first verse. We're going to get back to that seems to close the first song. We're going to get back to that verse afterwards. But let's begin by reading the beginning of the second song of Shir HaShirim, in which in the second song, the Dod initiates. Right? In the first song, the Raya initiated. She was the first one that was overwhelmed with excitement, and she comes out and she, you know, says all that she says. Well, look at what he says here, or she hears him coming. Kol Dodi Hinezeba Midaleg Al Harim Mikapetz Al Hagvaot. The sound of my beloved, behold, it is coming. He is skipping over the mountains. He is jumping on the hills. Right, it's a very animal-like imagery, right? And now, if we didn't quite get that yet, look at what she says in the next pasuk: Dome dodi litzvi ola ofer ha'ayalim. My beloved is like a gazelle and like a fawn of the hinds. Hineze omed achar kotlenu. He is standing behind our wall. Mashkiach min hachalonot mitzitz. Min hacharakim. He's looking in through the windows. He's peeking in through the cracks. Okay. Now, again, when we have this sort of continued imagery of the house, right? We remember that in the first song they built this joint house, and now in the second song he approaches the house. Of course, the image of the animal I think is an unforgettable one. It's a very powerful one. We're going to get back to that image, but he approaches the house, and I think we, the reader, sort of know what's going to happen. He's going to knock on the door. Right? May I come into the house that we constructed together in the first song? Well, that's not going to happen, right? So that our expectations are not, in fact, going to be fulfilled. But that's our sense, at least here. Instead of asking to come in, what the Dod is going to do is make an impassioned appeal for the Re'aya to come out, right? To begin her journey, and not even necessarily with him, right? Look at what he says. In Pasuk Yud, Ana Dodi ve'amarli, my beloved sang and said to me. Ana in Tanakh means to sing. Kumilach rayati yafati ulechilach, go for yourself, my beloved, my beautiful, and go for yourself. Kumilach ulechilach, not come with me, but go for yourself. What the Dod is asking of her is for her to begin her journey, for her to come out of the house and to perhaps run alongside him, perhaps parallel to him in the hills. Don't forget that in the beginning, he was running over the hills. He was skipping and jumping and prancing and leaping in a description which certainly evokes animal movement. And now he asks her to come out. Now, in order to understand perhaps what he's asking of her, I'd like to turn your attention to the first source that I gave out in today's source sheet. And this is a wonderful book written by Professor Yehuda Felix. He wrote this book on nature in Shir HaShirim, right? It was translated into English. He was a professor of biblical and Talmudic botany. And he writes about nature in Shir HaShirim, what we can learn from nature in Shir HaShirim. We'll be drawing several ideas from his book on Shir HaShirim. Look at what he says about animal courtship habits and mating rituals. He says as follows: Research into the life of the gazelle and the hind shows that it follows a certain pattern corresponding to the seasons of the year. Okay, this is called phenological growth, right? Something that corresponds to the seasons. The fawn lives under its dam's guard, but once grown up, goes off to join the herd of harts, which live away from their hinds. At first, the sexes are reciprocally indifferent and avoid each other. He calls that a period of estrangement. But when the mating season comes around, the harts begin to woo the hinds by alternately chasing and fleeing from them. This maneuver is rehearsed by the hinds. Each then goes in search of the selected mate, and eventually they couple. The course of love of the Re'aya and the Dod is patterned on that of the delightful denizens of the wild, and again described in the song. Just as gazelle or hind should be suffered to grow up and ripen according to nature's rules, so it will be with the Re'aya and the Dod. And I think it's a very, very wonderful description. It very much, I think, explains the imagery that's going on here in the background of Shir HaShirim. At this point in the story, then, I think that the courtship rituals of the animals, Dome, Dodi, Litzvi, Ola, Ofer, Ha'ayalim, are used as a metaphor for the beginning of the courtship of the couple. If they existed separately until now, perhaps building their house together, but certainly not living together, what we have here at the beginning of the second song is that the process is set into motion, right? The relationship takes off, it begins to gain momentum, all in its proper time. Timing is critical. If there's, you know, one word that describes all of tonight's shiur, it's eight le'ehov, right? It's there is a time to love, and that story has to develop alongside proper timing. The process begins, and this is a point that Felix makes also in his book. The process begins as nature begins to stir. Okay, winter has passed, and everywhere the land and the animals and the birds begin to awaken from their state of dormancy. Okay, Felix notes as follows. He says, in plant life, there are phenological seasons parallel to the stages in the love life of animals. And he says very explicitly, the deer, particularly he's talking about the Carmel deer, which I suppose he thinks is the one that we're talking about here. For the Carmel deer, courting is in the months of spring, and summer is the time that they mate. Okay, so here we have spring. We're going to see that in a moment, that we are actually talking about spring. But what is it, in fact, that he asks her here? He asks her to begin her running, right? So again, that the description that he gave here in source number one is not that they run together in the beginning, right? But that after the period of the estrangement, there then follows some sort of ritual, some sort of hide and seek period in which they run and they reveal themselves to each other. And then they go their own way. And then they come together again. And there's almost this, I guess you might call it a flirting period, right? Now the Midrash actually talks about this a lot. We're not going to talk too much about the Midrash today. We'll get back to it in our next class. But the Midrash actually likes this description very much for the man-God relationship. Right? That sometimes God is absent, that sometimes it's difficult to reveal ourselves to God, right? That there's this movement backwards and forwards, and we'll talk about that more next time. But here again, this seems to be this stage in the relationship, right? They're not moving into the house together. Later on, by the way, in the book, in one of perhaps the most well-known passages in Shir HaShirim, in chapter 5, right? Again, we're going to have Kol Dodi, right? But there it's Kol ani yeshena v'libi er, right? I am asleep and my heart is awake. Kol dodi dofek, right? The voice of my beloved is knocking. Now she's in the house and he comes towards the house. But what does he say? Pitchi li achoti yonati rayati ki rashi nimla tal kavutzotai risi seilaila. He says to her, open the door for me, right? I'm ready. The dew has come. It's the beginning. It's the dawn of the new day. Right? At that point, he asks her to come in, right? And then here he doesn't. And I think that we have to compare these two sections. They're very, very similar to see that he knows that the time is not yet ripe for him to move in. And what he asks her is to come outside. Now, this idea that timing is critical is, as I said, one of the very, very important ideas in Shir HaShirim, and it often draws on the life of animals, aside from the organic growth of nature, in order to make this point. So, for example, that oath that we saw in chapter two, verse 7, is going to appear again in chapter 3, verse 5. And in both of these cases, it's the same exact oath where she says, Hishpati etchem benot Yerushalayim, batzvaot o be'ayalot hasadeh. Right? What does she take an oath by? By the animals. Right? And she says that you should not awaken the love until the proper time. She invokes these animals as a model of proper timing, right? And again, her sense is, and I think this is a very important sense, because this is really going to be the key to understanding the nature theme in Shir HaShirim, is that if the love gets ahead of itself, and if it develops too quickly, and it outpaces its natural development, it endangers the very existence of the love, right? It can cause it to implode and not to develop properly if it's rushed. And that, I think, is is the point that she keeps making with these oaths. Sometimes she feels that her heart is getting ahead of where the relationship really is. And in order to put the brakes on it, she takes an oath. Love has a natural course. Just as animals mature, develop, and create eventually a symbiotic relationship in a gradual and organic way, sensitive both to the seasons around them and also the need to respond to nature, so too the human love and the divine love as well should and must be influenced by the slow, gradual growth, and perhaps even see the seasonal movements as the key to understanding how to get to the ultimate goal. And we're going to talk about that as well. In this section, what the Dode is then going to explain to her is why she should begin her running, but why they also shouldn't yet be together, right? In other words, he's going to offer, I think, a very cogent argument as to where they are in the relationship by using the blossoming of nature. This is going to be a very persuasive case for explaining to her and arguing where they are right now in the relationship. This is one of my favorite sections in Shir Shirim. Maybe I say that too much, but this really is a wonderful section in Shir Shirim. It's also the section I think that most develops the theme of natural growth. So let's look here at the continuation of his song. Right, we read Pasuk Yud. We read verse 10 where he sang to her and he said to her, "Kumi lach rayati afati ulechilach, get up for yourself and go." Look at what he explains to her. And he says, "Ki hineh stav avar." Okay, stav in Tanakh is not fall; it's winter. Okay, and you'll see why. The winter has passed. Hageshem chalaf halachlo. The rains have passed. They are gone. And this, by the way, is one of the proofs that the backdrop of Shir HaShirim is, of course, the land of Israel, right? Anybody who grew up in New York or, you know, in Europe, in England, knows that the rains actually never stop, right, in most countries. But here, again, there's a period, maybe not in most countries, but certainly in other countries. Here we have a period of the rains have passed. Hanitzanim nir uva aretz. The blossoms may be seen in the ground. Eight hazamir higia. The time of singing has arrived. V'kol hator nishma be'artzenu. And the sound of the turtle dove may be heard in our land. Ha'te'ina chanta fageha. The fig has opened up its blossoms. V'hagfanim smadar. And the vines are blossoms. Natnu reach. They have begun to give their fragrance. Kumi lach rayati afati ulechilach. Get up and go. And this closes the song, right? We have here a poetic inclusio, right? Where he begins by saying, get up and go. He ends by saying, get up and go. And in the interim, he explains to her why she should be convinced to leave her house, begin her running, but not to come with him. And what he really says to her is, first and foremost, look at the blossoming of the land. If, in fact, the blossoming of the land is meant to be parallel to the blossoming of their love, well, when they go outside and they see that the plants have begun to sprout, have begun to give their blossoms, on the most basic level is an indication that the roots that they planted in the first song have been successful, right? The roots have been struck and they have begun to give forth their blossoms. Note that in this section, as I mentioned before, the seasons have changed, which also indicates a new stage in their love, which is parallel to this new stage of nature. The long winter is over, the long dark winter, a winter of no growth, a winter in which all of the blossoms lay dormant under the earth, waiting for the time when the seeds can take root and begin to give forth their blossoms. And spring brings with it the fertility of the earth, the rebirth of the land. Ripe young blossoms, joy and vibrancy and optimism, right? That's what spring brings with it. And of course, also love and courtship and passion, right? Both the earth suggests optimism and the rituals of the animals, the courtship of the animals. The rains have gone. It is the time to go outside and breathe in the spring and experience this revitalized world. Okay, that's what he seems to be telling her. And by the way, I think that this is, someone asked me this at the end of the last class. This is probably one of the reasons that Shir HaShirim is read on Pesach. Right? Because, of course, this is during the spring or at the very beginning of the spring as we emerge from the dark winter rains, right? Last week it was raining and this week it's already not raining. Although we do hope that it rains again, certainly until Pesach, right? But Pesach, it marks the end of the rainy season. And we go outside during Pesach and we experience the reawakening of nature. And what I want to suggest is that that experience, which is described in our reading of Shir HaShirim, is meant also to awaken within us that youthful passion for God, which we experienced in the initial stages of our relationship with God, namely Yitziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, in which we first encountered our relationship with God, right? And so all these things come together, the blossoming of the land, the reawakening of love and of passion, and also trying to somehow foster a similar kind of experience within our man-God relationship, both on a communal level and on an individual level. And that's why Shir HaShirim is read on Pesach, and the spring happens as well then. Now, note that in this section, the senses that are used to perceive the development of nature are smell, right? We have the smell of the blossoms, hearing, right? We have the sound of the turtle dove, and sight, hanitzanim nir uba aretz, right? These are the senses that we use at the beginning of the relationship. The two senses that are not yet used are, of course, taste, because we don't yet have the full development of the fruits, and touch, right? There's no touch yet. And again, there's that sense of perhaps distance, but also tactile interaction seems to be discouraged. The fruits are not yet ripe. I'm told that if you touch a fruit before it's ripe, you might ruin it, right? If you start feeling the figs on your fig tree, I have a fig tree, so sometimes I go out, I feel the figs, and I was told, don't touch them because you're not supposed to even touch them before they are ripe, right? And that we have here as well, the possibility of fruits. That's what lies at the heart of the Dode song. We're in an interim stage here, right? On the one hand, evidence that the relationship is developing properly, is going in the right direction. On the other hand, not yet able to reap the fruits of the relationship. Note also that in addition to the animal images that we've seen in this song and the blossoming of the land, there are some other interesting natural images as well. So, for example, birds, right? Eit hazamir higia v'kol hator nishma v'artzenu. Zamir, there's a little bit of an argument as to what the zamir is, right? Some people want to say it's actually pruning, right? It might actually mean the time for pruning has arrived. It seems, though, that the time for pruning, certainly the vine, is at the end of winter, right? At the end of winter, when all the energy is stored up in the branches, that's when you prune. And this is not the end of winter, right? This seems to be more the beginning of spring. It seems a little late for pruning. What Professor Felix suggests is that Zamir just means a songbird, right? The time for the songbird has arrived. And of course, that parallels the sound of the turtle dove, right? And this bird, we know, well, let's look at what Felix says about these birds, okay? The zamir and the turtle dove. He says, the zamir and the turtle dove are the harbingers of spring. Songbirds begin to nest and brood once the cold winter months are past. The courting, the fashioning of nests, and the care of the fledglings are thrilling diversions that quicken them to break out into melody after the long spell of wintry silence. Then, early in April, flights of turtle doves begin to arrive. They nest in wood or coppice and fill the air with their incessant cooing. Tour, right? It's an onomatopoeia. They're called the tour because they actually make a sound that sounds like their name. Okay, so here we have this description of these birds who are not in Eretz Yisrael during the winter. They go down, they fly south in the direction of Africa, for the winter, during which time their songs are not heard, Be'artzenu, in the land of Israel. And in the spring, they come back to the land of Israel in order to build nests and start a family, singing as they work. Okay, so this is also both a harbinger of spring and also, I think, a delightful metaphor, right? You have these birds that are constructing their nests, which are also, I think, parallel to the building of the house that we saw at the initial stages of the relationship between the Dodah and the Raya. So at this preliminary stage in nature's growth, the relationship is in a preliminary stage. And this is why the Dodah does not ask to come into the house. This is why he says, do this for you, start your running, you will run separately from me. And as the nature or progresses, or I should say perhaps the opposite way, as the relationship progresses, nature progresses. And the two really run parallel to each other throughout Shir HaShirim. As nature's development follows its onward, forward course, the relationship follows its onward, forward course with the ultimate goal, of course, being the fruits, right? Reaping the fruits and enjoying every stage along the way, enjoying the sights and the smells and the beauty and the optimism and the excitement of this experience. And what we see throughout Shir HaShirim, and this I want to show you inside, is that throughout, the Dodah and the Raya are very aware of nature being a backdrop and maybe even a metaphor for the development of the relationship, so that we keep having them go down to the gardens, going out to the orchards, going to the fields in order to survey the growth of the trees and the flowers, to check on nature, to make sure that things are growing as they should. And of course, the idea being is that if you see that nature is responding, right, so then the assumption is that the relationship is also responding, that there's this parallel that's being created. I'm going to explain why I think the parallel is so important shortly. But first, I want you to see some of these descriptions. These are a little bit more brief than the description that we just saw, but they really continue and they progress throughout the book. So look, for example, at chapter 6, verse 2. Right, where the Benot Yerushalayim, they go looking for the Dodah, right? She's lost her Dodah. We'll talk about that a little bit in the next class. And the Benot Yerushalayim in verse 1, and again, it's a terrible division, right? This is just not a new chapter, right? It's the continuation of the previous chapter. So in verse 1, the Benot Yerushalayim turn to her and say, Ana halach dodeh chayafa benashim. Where did your beloved go, O most beautiful of women? Ana pana dodeh unevakshenu imach. We want to find him. He sounds really terrific. We want to go look for him. And she gets a little protective over him, and she says, Dodi yarad legano. My beloved has gone down to his garden, la arugot habosem, to the beds of spices, lirot baganim, vililkot shoshanim. He has gone to shepherd those gardens. That's a little bit of a mixing of metaphors there, right? And to pick the beautiful flowers, right? So he's going down to the garden, and he is enjoying the development of nature. Look ahead at verse 11 in chapter 6, in the same chapter. We actually don't know who's speaking in this verse. There's a tremendous amount of controversy. We don't know, but I'll read for you the verse anyway. In any case, it's either the Dodah or the Raya. El ginat egoz yaradti. I went down to the nut garden, lirot be'ibei hanachal, to see the plants of the wadi, lirot hafarcha hagefen heinetsu harimonim, to see has the vine blossomed? Have the pomegranates begun to bloom? Right? That's what they want to see. They want to go down and see, has nature responded to our cultivation of our relationship? And look ahead, for example, we'll see one more example, but I think you see as we're progressing, nature is progressing as well. Look in Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yud Bet. We'll start in chapter 7, verse 12, where the Re'aya is speaking to her Dod here, and she says, Lecha Dodi. We're almost at the end of Shir HaShirim here, right? So she says, let us go, my beloved. Neitzeh Asadeh. Let's go out to the field. Nalina Bakifarim. I'm going to disagree with this explanation here, and with the translation. Let us lie among the henna plants. Okay, Kfarim, I don't think are villages. I think it's a kind of a plant, the kofar, right? We had it previously in Perek Aleph. Nashkima lakramim, we will awaken in the vineyards near im parcha hagefen, pitach hasmadar. We will see whether the vine has opened, whether the blossoms have begun to open. Hinetsu harimonim, have the pomegranates put out their blossoms? Shum etain et dodailach. There I will give you my love. Right? So they go out first to check on nature, and then she promises him that they will be together. Pasuk Yudalad, one more pasuk we'll read here. Hadudaim natnu reach. The mandrakes have given their smell. The alpatachenu kol megadim, and all of the finest fruits are on the entrance of our doorway. Right there, we go back again to that house imagery. They're now in the doorway of their house, but it's filled with the fruits. Right, they've picked the fruits. It's now piling up on their doorway. Chadashim gam yishanim, the new fruits as well as the old fruits. Dodi Safantilach, my beloved, I have kept this in store for you. Okay, so this really is, to some extent, the height of Shir HaShirim. The fruits have ripened. They have been picked. They have been placed on their doorstep. All manner of fruits, young and old, the finest fruits. And of course, the thriving of the land is meant to be seen as parallel to the thriving of their love, and also as a prerequisite to the culmination of their love here in Shir HaShirim. So this natural imagery is really very important in Shir HaShirim. It's used also in the three occasions upon which the Dod and the Raya describe each other physically, right? So we have actually four. He describes her physically, her face, her body. We saw that a little bit in the first class, three times, and she describes him at great length once. And there are many, many natural images that are used there as well, which draw from the world of the blossoming of nature, and of course the world of animals. So animals and birds and flowers and fruits and spices are always drawn upon to animate their love, to describe their love, and to also, I think, give a sense that their love is also organic, right? It's also natural, is also developing in a gradual, almost seasonal way, right? Okay, so this is, I think, the general picture of Shir HaShirim that I wanted to show you. And now I want to ask the question, what does this idea teach us about Shir HaShirim and the human relationship in it? And perhaps more significantly, what does this mean for the deeper idea of Shir HaShirim, which we, of course, keep coming back to? And that is, of course, the Holy of Holies, the relationship between humans and God. So once again, I want to note that the origins of this very basic idea in Shir HaShirim, like many basic ideas, are in Gan Eden, right? The origins of this story and of the idea that underlies the relationship between the Dod and the Raya, along with nature, appears in the foundational story, which is, of course, the story of the Garden of Eden. That is our foundational story, the story which exists as a model for illustrating mankind's purpose and how he can achieve that purpose. Right? So we spoke about that a lot in our previous class, but I'm really looking back to the Garden of Eden all the time to try to understand, what does God want from mankind, and what tools does God give to mankind in order to enable mankind to achieve that? So humankind, of course, begins its relationship with God in a natural setting, in a blossoming garden, which God plants for the explicit purpose of placing man in it. More significantly, of course, is that man's mission in the garden is le'ovda u'lishomra, to work that garden, to cultivate that garden, to basically to be a farmer, right? Man is created to be a farmer. Adam Harishon, man of chapter 2, whose basic goal in life is to communicate with the divine, to interact with God, to appreciate and internalize what it means to be in a garden in which Kol Hashem mitalech bitocha, in which the voice of God, look at that, Kol Hashem again, which the voice of God is walking around it. He has as his singular assignment the cultivation of the land. That's really the only thing that God instructs him to do. He also tells him what not to do. Now, I talked a lot about the way in which the human relationship, the relationship between Adam and Chava, the Ish and the Isha, also gives man the tools for finding a relationship with God. But actually, that's not God's command to man. God's command to Adam HaRishon is work the garden, cultivate the garden. Now, I would imagine that this charge, this task, this mission must have a spiritual component to it, right? Why does God direct Adam HaRishon to cultivate the earth? So one way to understand this, and this is, by the way, I think the most common way of understanding it in Chazal, like in the different Midrashim, is that this is just a metaphor, right? Cultivating the garden is a metaphor for Adam HaRishon's real task, which is to cultivate his relationship with God. So if we look here at this series of Midrashim that I brought for you, right? Let's start in source number 3, right? It's the Midrash really here just raises the question, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, Ma avodai ta betoch hagan, shamar leovda. What kind of agricultural work was he doing in the garden that it says that he should work it? Shema tomar lizmor kramim? You think that he was actually pruning vineyards? Vilachrosh, vilashaded ha'adama? Was he plowing and harrowing the earth? Was he turning it over in preparation for planting? Oliktzor, ola amer? Was he reaping? Was he tying things into sheaves? The description in the actual story is that nature sort of blossomed on its own. Remember, God already made the garden with kol eitz nechmad lemar'eh v'tov lemalachal. Shema tomar yesh melachah began Eden, v'alo nahar moshech v'yotzeh me'eden. He doesn't even really need to water because we have that beautiful river that runs through Eden, right? And so the Midrash asks the question, the Ramban picks up on this question as well. I want to show some of the answers to the question in different Midrashim. So look, for example, in source number 4, the Midrash in Bereishit Rabbah on the words v'yenicheu bagan le'ovda u'lishomra says v'yenicheu natan lo mitzvat Shabbat. That means he gave him the mitzvah of Shabbat. K'madat amar v'yanach b'yom ha'shvi'i, right? Because there's that linguistic parallel between the description of resting and the description of placing him, right? So that actually it's the opposite of agricultural work, right? And what does le'ovda mean? Sheshet yamim tavod. Ulishomra, shmorit yom ha'shabbat l'kodesho, right? It's Midrash does a wonderful job of showing how this pasuk is metaphoric, right? He's never meant to really do agricultural work. Agricultural work is a metaphor for cultivating a spiritual relationship with God. There's another opinion in the same Midrash. Davar acher, lo'ovda ulishomra, elu ha'korbanot. That's talking about sacrifices. Actually, God placed Adam HaRishon in the garden to bring sacrifices. Shenemar tavdun et Elokim uktiv tishmeru la'akriv li b'maado. The word ovda and the word shumra is often used in order to describe the act of bringing sacrifices. That must be what is meant here. Again, we can understand the difficulty. The difficulty is the question that I raised previously, which is, what is the point? What is the point of this agricultural work? It must have a spiritual component. And the next Midrash, which we won't read inside, it makes a similar suggestion, just suggesting that it means learning Torah, right? So in other words, the cultivation of the garden, according to all these Midrashim, is a metaphor for cultivating a relationship with God, whether it's keeping Shabbos or bringing sacrifices or learning Torah. And by the way, this is very reminiscent of what I described in the first class as the common approach to the human relationship in the simple meaning of Shir HaShirim, which so many biblical interpreters regard as a metaphor. And this resonates true. On one level, it certainly resonates true. But I'd like to suggest once again, just as I suggested in the first class when I was discussing the man-woman relationship in Shir HaShirim, that here as well, we're not meant to regard the idea of man cultivating the garden merely as a metaphor. It's also a metaphor. But that humans live in a finite world. We live in a world that must be cultivated. We live in a world that must be tended and nurtured. Many efforts must be made and energy exerted to make the ground yield its fruit. Maybe not in the Garden of Eden, but eventually. Now, it's possible, of course, that man would simply do so for pragmatic purposes, but I would like to venture the idea that if, in fact, man is being given the charge of being a farmer in the foundational story, which is meant to teach him how to cultivate a relationship with God, that this experience as well is a prologue to and a reflection of the man-God relationship. I've adopted Rav Soloveitchik's phrase with regard to the man-woman relationship, and I've simply placed it into the context of what it means to nurture the land. In other words, by becoming a farmer, by engaging in agricultural activity, it prepares man to be a spiritual being. The experience itself of actually working the land, not a metaphor, of actually working the land is what equips people with the tools and the personality and the character to properly cultivate a relationship with God. I would add another dimension to this as well, which is that not only is mankind's relationship with nature a prologue to and a reflection of his relationship with God, but it also may be designed to aid him and to provide him with the tools in his relationship with woman. Right? The man-woman relationship may also be improved by whatever it is, or may also be defined by whatever it is that people experience when they work the land in order to make the land yield its fruit. The same lessons and tools which human beings acquire in their agricultural activities may be applied in different directions. And I'd like to suggest that we've created here really three interconnected levels of relationship between nature, the human relationships, and man's relationship or human's relationship with God. And these relationships intertwine and cross-pollinate, right? As one area is perfected and refined, it necessarily impacts on another area as well, thereby strengthening all three areas simultaneously and progressively, right? So there's almost this snowball effect, which where one growth affects another growth, and the movement forward in one area necessarily is meant to be translated into a movement forward in the other two areas. And ultimately, the story is designed in order to expand the scope, the intensity, and the passion in each of the relationships. Now, in order to understand what it is about the agricultural relationship or the working the land that is really meant to be translated into the man-God relationship, I think that we have to understand this a little bit more deeply. There's these human activities, right? The actions that are necessary for coaxing the earth to yield its produce foster qualities which I think are necessary for fostering relationships, for cultivating relationships, and certainly within the divine realm as well. Right? We're talking about hard work. We're talking about constant vigilance. We're talking about unremitting commitment, the patience to await the fruits of one's labors, sensitivities to the fluctuations and dangers which can ruin the crops and threaten the relationship. All of this, I think, contribute to the devotion and the commitment which human beings are meant to cultivate, both in their relationship to each other and in their relationship to God. Now, I want to, though, take you a little bit in a different direction. It's a direction that I found in this next source, in this wonderful essay by Rav Soloveitchik. The essay was published only in Shiurei HaRav, although it appeared in several journals as well. It's an essay called Sacred and Profane. And Rav Soloveitchik makes a little bit of a more abstract point. Rav Soloveitchik notes that a landowner, a farmer, develops a passionate relationship, what he calls a mental bond with his land. Devotion to land is a unique experience. That's what he says. He's going to talk here about Kedushat HaMakom, right? How man obtains this sense of what he calls place consciousness. And we're going to see that inside. But he says really a person who owns land is a person of strength, a person of great a sense of self, because his identity merges with his land. He has place consciousness. Let's look at what he says here. He says, the settler can be understood Oh, this is not the part. Yeah, the settler, the first source on page two. The settler tills and cultivates his land. He prays for rain, and he combats the elements that would drive him from his land. He does not wish to find new pastures, for these are integrated with his existence. The settler has a land attachment. His land has become part and parcel of his mental set. He lives in a symbiotic relationship with his, I think that that's supposed to be land, with his land, although love works as well. He has tilled it and it has produced. He loves it and merges in it. A farmer, says Rav Soloveitchik, becomes deeply suffused with his passion for his land. It is expressed in his attachment to it, in his willingness to take strong action on its behalf. When the rains don't come, he prays for the rains. When the elements try to drive him from his land, he is willing to fight those elements. He does not relinquish his land. It's the idea of nachala, right? Remember the story of Navot HaKarmeli, right? Who Achav, his palace is juxtaposed to the vineyard of Navot. And Achav really wants that vineyard. And he says, can I have the vineyard? And Navot's response is a passionate no. Chalila li mititi et nachalat avotai lach. No, I will never relinquish my land. A man with place attachment does not seek new pastures, even when times are difficult, even when the land is not easily yielding its fruit. Agricultural man's deep devotion to his land produces a situation in which he merges with his land. His identity merges with his land, and it becomes part of his consciousness. Now, this experience, says Rav Soloveitchik, is meant to shape man's ability. When I say man, of course, I mean human. Human's ability to have a relationship with God. A devoted farmer, someone who has a sense of attachment to their land, can develop that kind of attachment in their other relationships as well. And that, says Rav Soloveitchik, is the way that humans have to love God, with a sense of passion and immersion, with a sense that the I is suffused and integrated with the thou. Love for God becomes integrated into his very identity. And this is what he learns from developing a relationship with the land. Rav Soloveitchik further suggests an analogy between the depth of a person's spiritual values and the depth of the farmer's relationship to his land. In this next citation that I brought for you, this next section, he says, I think, some really wonderful and very relevant things, and I want to read it for you in source number 7. Look at what he says here. He says, settlers can be understood in a symbolic sense. When he means settlers, he doesn't mean what we mean by settlers, right? He means people who have land attachment in terms of spiritual values. In the settler, we observe the merger of the worshiper and his God. One who has no such personal integration with a world perspective is a nomad. Okay, now he's going to talk about a spiritual nomad. Someone who has no attachment to land and wanders from place to place is going to have a hard time becoming attached to a world of values, to a world that has a relationship with God. He has no place consciousness, no sense of belongingness. It is only when knowledge becomes an integral part of his existence and consciousness through the medium of mental bonds that it may be truly said that the spiritual nomad has come home to a place of his own. Look at this next quote. I skipped a lot just because, you know, I was trying to find a way to summarize pages and pages. So I put, you know, these three dots. I could have even skipped a whole page here, so just that you should know. Look at what he says here in this next line. Indifferent knowledge and a skeptical approach to ideals and norms will never result in a multidimensional personality. The religious telos finds its full realization in the passionate religious life, permeated with enthusiasm and rapture. I live in God. I think, feel, and exist through him. He permeates my life and gives it meaning and content. As the settler experiences his home, as man intuits space, so does the Jew intuit God. I think it's a wonderful paragraph here. And here, I think what the Rav is saying is that the experience of devotion to the land, of creating a symbiotic relationship with the land, is one which is meant to merge with the spiritual persona and teach the spiritual men and humans how to shape the nature of their relationship with God. So this is one aspect of being a farmer that is a prologue to and a reflection of humans' relationship with God. I want to make one more brief point, and then I want to get to the last point of this year. One additional brief point that I'd like to suggest that is perhaps relevant to this charge to humankind to develop the land is that in his role as farmer, right, which I think is somehow meant to prepare him for his role in a relationship with God, man is a producer and a creator. He doesn't just take, he gives. He contributes to the world. He doesn't exist in some sort of self-enclosed lifestyle in which his private existence is of paramount importance. Instead, he is tilling the land in an effort to benefit all of humanity, right? The farmer is building the world. He's producing. He's looking at the world as a place where he is given the charge to reduva aretz v'kiv shuha, right? To conquer the land. This too, I think, has to be understood in the context of the relationship between man and God, right? Man is not created to live his life in a uncreative, static existence in which his spiritual relationship with God is only exists between himself and God. He's called upon to utilize his spiritual potential within a broader communal context. He is called upon to regard himself as responsible for the world around him, to see himself with the task of caring for nature and inducing it to yield to mankind's needs and the world at large. So that's one side point that I wanted to make. It's a brief point, but I think it's an important one, and I think it also is a relevant one. I'd like to spend the next few minutes illustrating one particular natural image that is perhaps the predominant natural image in Shir HaShirim, and that is, of course, the vineyard, right? The vineyard. Their love is often portrayed as a vineyard. By the way, in Tanakh, the relationship between man and God is often metaphorically described as a vineyard, right? Think of Yeshayahu Perek Hay, right? The fifth chapter of Isaiah, or the 80th chapter of Psalms, right? Of Tehillim, right? So for those of you who want to look those up, in both of those situations, the relationship between man and God is described as being a vineyard. And this is certainly the most important image in Shir HaShirim. It of course also, I think, reflects the fact that vines and grapes are a very important crop in Eretz Yisrael, especially in the hilly areas, right? Here in Jerusalem and more particularly where I'm from Gush Etzion, right? And the development of the grape, whose ultimate goal is the wine. It's a relevant topic, having just celebrated Purim, right? Right. Is of course a major theme which runs throughout the book, right? We saw in the first class that that the Raya's initial claim that her flawed beauty is not her own fault is based on her description of her brothers who forced her to guard their vineyard. Carmi shali lo notarti, right? I did not get to tend my own vineyard, which seems to be a metaphoric allusion to her lack of preparation of her character, of her personality for this relationship. And this kind of, this particular image, it appears over and over in Shir HaShirim. So look, for example, in chapter 2, verse 15. Here we have the Re'aya who refuses her dod's initial call, right? He calls her to come out and she doesn't, right? We actually didn't mention that the end of the story is that she doesn't go out and commence her running. She refuses to come. And she explains to him why. In verse 15 in chapter 2, she says, "Echezu lanu shualim, shualim kitanim. These little foxes have grabbed hold of us. Mechablim kramim. They destroy vineyards. Uchramenu smadar. And our vineyard is only in the initial stages. I'm not sure it can withstand this attack. Its roots aren't deep enough yet. It is young and vulnerable." Right? So this is a metaphor. Right? She's explaining, I don't think we're ready yet. Right? I think that if something external to us comes and threatens this vineyard, which is, of course, the description of the relationship, I'm not sure if it would be able to withstand it. Now, we saw in both of those previous psukim, which we saw them going down to the garden to check on the blossoms, right? One of the things that they were checking on always was the vineyard, right? Right? Le'ota parcha ha-gefen, pitach ha-smadar. They're very concerned about the vineyard, and the vine is always checked for the grape blossoms. And ultimately, of course, at the end of Shir HaShirim, she says very, very confidently and proudly, Karmi sheli lifanai. My vineyard is before me. This is an observation that concludes Shir HaShirim with the conclusion that she is fully responsible for the relationship and for the development of the relationship, and she is fully confident that she has planted a great vineyard. Right? That's chapter 8, verse 11. And all of this, I think, seems to be indicating that the ultimate goal of the relationship, on one level, is wine. Right? And that's what she says at the very beginning. She says, Yishakeni minishikot piyu ki tovim dodecha miayin. Right? Your love is better than wine, right? And she wants to drink the wine, right? We see that over and over and over. We see it in chapter 2, we see it in chapter 5, we see it in chapter 7, we see it in chapter 8, right? Over and over and over, she's looking for the wine. A midrash notes the significance of the wine imagery in Shir HaShirim. I want you to see it here. It's in source number 8. It's a great midrash. The midrash here explains this dominant image, and it says as follows: Ki tovim dodecha miyain nimshelu divrei Torah b'mayim b'yayin b'shemen b'dvash. V'chalav, right? Torah is compared to 5 different images. And then the Midrash is going to go on and explain what is the significance of each one. I skipped until they got to the part with the wine. Look at what it says. Talmud lomar, yayin. Why wine? Ma yayin kol zman shehu mityashen bekankan mishtabeach kach divrei Torah kol zman shehem mityashnim begufo shel adam heim mishtabchim begdula. Right? So the idea is that as wine ages, it gets better with age. Well, so too you could say about Torah. Talmud Lomar, here's another one. Yayin. Ma hayayin nikar baguf? Kach divrei Torah nikarin baguf. Just as you can easily recognize someone who has imbibed wine, so too you can easily recognize someone who has absorbed words of Torah. It's recognizable physically. People point at that person and say, that is a person who has absorbed Torah. Tamid lomar, yayin. Ma yayin misameach et halev. Just as wine gladdens the heart. Dichti v'yayin isameach levav enosh. Kach divrei Torah misamchin lev. Just as wine gladdens people's heart, so do divrei Torah. And in case you think we're getting a little too carried away with our excitement over the wine here, let's look at our last example. I skipped over a little bit and I'm on the last line. E. Ma hayayin. Pa'amim shehu ra larosh v'laguf. Yachol af divrei Torah ken. Sometimes the wine isn't good. Sometimes it distorts. So too, divrei Torah can distort. That's an incredible thing for the Midrash to say. Okay, so, but I mean, I think, obviously, the Midrash is specifically talking about the context of their particular reading of the Nimshal, which here, in this case, is Divrei Torah. But I think very, very easily, we can apply these ideas to the relationship on both levels. The human relationship, the divine relationship, certainly improves with age, certainly visibly changes a person, certainly brings joy. And of course, because of its overwhelming and overpowering effect on the human personality, it has potential both for good and potential to make man evil. It has potential for greatness and potential for baseness, for vulgarity and for distortion. And I think that the wine is a wonderful image in Shir HaShirim, where the ultimate goal of the relationship is some sort of state of changing one's inner consciousness, right? Tapping into perhaps more deeper spiritual resources, experiencing the world in a totally different way, right? And really, I think tapping into some sort of deeper self. And that, I think, really is what the wine is about. I want to return to our original topic and close with that, and that is the organic nature of relationships, which progress in parallel to and in consonance with the growth and development of the land. Everything, as we noted, has a season. Eit lehov, right? L'chol zman va'eit tachat hashamayim. Everything has a proper season. The seeds must be placed in the ground in the proper season. When the ground is ripe and plowed and prepared to absorb the seeds, the land must be fertilized and watered. And then, of course, we have the long season of winter, a season in which the fruits are not seen and the development continues to occur underground. The period of dormancy is a critical period. It's not a wasted period. It is a critical period. It is a waiting period. Perhaps one might even call it a suspension of life until conditions are right for the explosive growth of nature. And we're going to talk about this in the nimshal in our next class when we talk about the idea of galut and geula. Right? Think of galut as a period of dormancy, a period of the winter, a period of underground, which is a critical period in the growth of the relationship between man and God. We're going to talk about that afterwards in our next class. But this idea that proper timing is of the essence is actually expressed in a magnificent midrash. And this midrash is particularly important because it's carefully placed at the climactic conclusion of Shira Shirim Rabbah, right? It's the very last midrash. That's not by coincidence. When you have the very last midrash, what we're being told is that this rings true. If you walk out of our learning of Shir HaShirim with this idea, you've learned Shir HaShirim. So let's look at this midrash. The midrash here in source number 9 says as follows, Be'arba'a devarim nimshala ge'ulatan shel Yisrael. To four things, the redemption of Israel is compared. Ba'katzir uva'batzir ba'besamim uva'yoleda. To harvest, to the grape harvest, to spices, and to childbirth. Bakatsir, what does it mean that the Geula of Yisrael is compared to the reaping? Hada chakla, kad hamachtzida below inta, afilu tivna leitu tav. This, if you would reap before the proper time, even straw would not, it wouldn't even be good to be used for straw. Beinta, but if you pick it at its proper time, hutav. It's good. And this is what it's going to say about each of these cases. Just skip down to four lines from the bottom where we have nimshala, four lines on the bottom. Nimshala kayoleda. It is also compared to childbirth. Hada itita, that woman, kad yalda below inta, lo chaya vlada. Right? If she gives birth before the proper time, the fetus won't live. Kad yaladet beinta chay. But if she gives birth in the proper time, it will leave. Kach ktiv l'chein yitneim ad eit yoleida yalada. Rav Acha b'shem Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi amar, Ani Hashem b'ita achishena. I am God, and in the proper time, I will hurry it up. Lo zechitem b'ita zechitem achishena. Okay, we'll leave that aside for a moment. Now, the idea, I think, indicates that one of the ideas that we emerge with from Shir HaShirim is what we learn from nature, which is that nature teaches us that things must grow and ripen properly. They have to be given time to develop naturally and in a genuine manner. This is true about human love. It's true about divine love. And I think one might also conclude that good things, valuable things, profound relationships and experiences, real meaning and inspired living don't come easily. There are no shortcuts. That's what Rav Amital Zatzal who used to say. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of Har Etzion. He was fond of saying, "Ein patentim." Right? There are no shortcuts. If you want to develop that relationship, if you want the land to grow and yield its fruit, you have to plant the seeds, you have to water it, you have to prune it and cultivate it and nurture it. And there's a maturing process in relationships. There is a spring and a summer and an autumn of every relationship. This is something that gradually unfolds. It's true about every human relationship. It's true about raising children. And it's true about the man-woman relationship, and it's also true about the man-God relationship, both on a communal level and on an individual level. Am Yisrael's initial excitement when they come out of Egypt and they're at the Yam Suf, their overwhelming expression of excitement and faith, Vayaminu Ba'Hashem uveMoshe Avdo, they believed in God, quickly dissipates and disintegrates and becomes mistrust, complaints, and doubt. Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is God really with us or not? And this is the case, of course, on an individual level as well. The human quest to create a relationship with God is not a quick and easy fix. It's not an effortless path to the spiritual. It's not some sort of inspirational, meteoric experience, right? It's rather a slow and arduous and painstaking process which requires a certain development. Rav Amital, in this vein, used to often cite a wonderful midrash, which we actually don't have in the midrash. We only have it quoted by the Maharal. So I brought it for you here in the Maharal. I'll paraphrase it because we're really at the end of our time. But the midrash seems to be dealing with the question of what's the most important pasuk in the Torah. Right? I could certainly come up with lots of great ones. Right? The midrash here suggests maybe it's Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. That seems to be an obvious pick. Or maybe it's V'ahavta et Re'acha Kamocha, right? I could add many to that one. Maybe it's Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? And then the final opinion is that of Ben Pazi, and he says, no. The most important verse in the Tanakh is Et HaKeves HaEchad Ta'aseh V'Boker Ve'et HaKeves HaSheni Ta'aseh Ben Harbaim. One sheep you bring in the morning and the other you bring in the afternoon, right? It's the daily commitment. It's tefillah. It's the gradual, arduous process of developing a relationship with God. Not the one that's marked by dramatic and spectacular revelation, but one which reflects the slow and steady movement towards deepening our commitment. Perhaps to compound this point that I've been making tonight, our yearly holiday cycle is linked with the agricultural one, right? I mentioned it a little bit previously. Every year, on an annual basis, as winter draws to a close and the world of nature begins to awaken from its slumber, we internalize and recast that experience in our spiritual world as well. We recall the springtime of our relationship with God. We celebrate Passover. We read Shir HaShirim, and we re-experience the dazzling excitement and the great overwhelming joy of the initial stages of our passion with God. On Shavuot, as we harvest the beginning of the grain produce, we approach what may be called the middle age of our relationship with God, where we were given commandments and the daily pragmatics of existence. We recall Har Sinai, the solidifying of the relationship, and we read Megillat Rut, which records the pragmatic and daily quest for food and continuity. And on Sukkot, as we gather in the final fruits of the agricultural harvest, we sit in our Sukkot in a reflective posture, reading Kohelet and contemplating the meaning of our achievements and success. This process is performed on a yearly basis, such that we re-experience the way in which the world of nature mirrors and paves the way for the development of our relationship with God every single year. To conclude, Shir HaShirim and the Tanakh offer a broader view of how we are meant to interact with the world around us. Nature, the natural world, the blossoming of the land, the habits of animals have much to teach us in our developing relationship with God. Let nature be your teacher. If we fail to properly develop a relationship with the finite world in which we live, we will fail to understand and extract the necessary knowledge meant to be applied to the infinite world. If, on the other hand, we understand the messages gleaned from the observable world around us, our relationship with God should deepen, acquired by virtue of having inculcated the lessons imbued in God's magnificent landscape, designed and created to mirror and to foster our spiritual personality. Thank you.
Yeah.